You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. We're going to be talking today to Wade Davis. He's an anthropologist whose work has made an impact far beyond the halls of academia. He's the author of many books, including the bestsellers The Serpent and the Rainbow, One River, and The Wayfinders. I think his work is so compelling, both because he's a superb and vivid writer. You go on a journey with him and you're so in the moment and you're never bogged down by jargon or unfamiliar science talk. And also because the places he writes about are incredibly fascinating and they make us realize, or they make me realize, that we North Americans are not the measure of all things, all places, and all people. There is a great big world that we can learn from and that we can really be humble before. Wade Davis is going to be speaking in Santa Fe very soon. I'll tell you all about that right after this announcement. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential. Offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. I'm very happy now to welcome author and anthropologist Wade Davis. He's a professor at the University of British Columbia, and he will be speaking here in Santa Fe on Tuesday, February 26th at 7 o'clock on the subject Why Ancient Wisdom Matters. It's at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So the subtitle of your book, The Wayfinders, is Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World. That's also the title of your upcoming lecture in Santa Fe. And in that book, you write about a lot of different societies from all over the world, Polynesian, Inuit, Buddhist, many people of the Amazon basin, and many others. And one of the themes that comes up in many of these societies is that many of them have a very different sense of time from ours. And in fact, some of them don't even have a word for time. What does it mean for how a society sees itself when it doesn't have a linear sense of time? And what is the experience like living each day?
Well, I think many societies don't have a concrete sense of time. Obviously, they're aware of the passing of the seasons in the temperate areas, or the seasonality even in the tropics, or the shifting of the moon. It's not like they are not aware of the passage of time. I mean, people age, people are born, they die. But in many societies, the rhythm of that cycle are set by the natural world, you know, whether it's a maturation of certain species of palm or the emergence of certain insects at certain times of year. And I think that, you know, the central thrust of that book, The Wayfinders, and I must admit that the subtitle was something slapped onto the cover by the publisher, not really something that I meant to do in the book. I mean, I'm not even sure what ancient wisdom really means in that sense.
But right.
The real central core of that book is the basic revelation of anthropology. You know, the idea that every culture has something to say. Each deserves to be heard, just as none has monopoly on the route to the divine. You know, it's fascinating that if you think back to the events in our lifetime that will be remembered 10,000 years hence, certainly one of them would be the moment on Christmas Eve of 68 when, you know, Apollo went around the dark side of the moon and we emerged to see for the first time in human history, not a sunrise or a moonrise, but an earthrise. And in that kind of crystal moment of awareness, everything changed. We suddenly realized we weren't an infinite horizon. We were a single small orb, as the astronauts famously remarked, floating in the velvet void of space. There's been a similar scientific breakthrough in our lifetimes that hasn't quite yet entered the zeitgeist of the age, if you will, and that is the extraordinary revelations of modern genetics. You know, geneticists have proven without doubt that the genetic endowment of humanity is a continuum. Race is an utter fiction. We are all cut from the same genetic cloth. In fact, the data suggests that we're all descendants of that same handful of people who stumbled out of Africa some 65,000 years ago and then embarked on this extraordinary journey that in 40,000 years allowed human beings to settle every corner of the planet that was habitable. But the amazing revelation is that if you accept the truth of science, and we are all cut from the same genetic cloth, it means by definition that all human societies essentially share the same raw mental acuity, the same intellectual genius, and how that genius is expressed is simply a matter of choice. You know, we may celebrate technological wizardry, and that's a great mark of our brilliance. But other societies place more emphasis, for example, on unraveling the mystic threads of memory inherent in a myth. But the most important thing is that we all share that common human endowment. And therefore, there is no hierarchy in the affairs of culture. That old Victorian idea that we somehow, you know, it went from the savage to the barbarian to the civilized of the Strand of London has been absolutely ridiculed by modern science and shown to be an artifact of the 19th century, no more relevant to our lives today than the notion that clergymen had in that era that the earth was but 6,000 years old. In this kind of stunning affirmation of the human spirit, genetics has actually come to the fore to bridge that chasm that existed between nature, nurture, biology, anthropology, to really prove the central revelation of Franz Boas, which was cultural relativism, which was the idea that the world you were born into was just a model of reality, and that the other peoples of the world weren't failed attempts at being you. On the contrary, every culture is, by definition, a unique answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? When the peoples of the world answer that question, they do so in the 7,000 different voices of humanity. And those voices and those answers collectively become our kind of human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us in the ensuing centuries. So that's really the lesson of anthropology that I was trying to distill in the book, The Wayfinders.
One of the things that what you're saying calls into question is the notion of progress and the notion of improvement. And for me and for many of us as Americans, it's kind of bred into the bone to think that we are in a continual path of progress, path of improvement, of self-improvement. You know, the arc of the moral universe has long advanced towards justice. There are also people who have, I mean, you have an amazing passage in this book where you describe Aboriginal people in Australia who don't at all have an ethic of or a sense of progress or improvement. What is that like? I mean, you have the extraordinary experience of having lived and breathed and worked in these places and gotten to have not only a kind of intellectual sense, but a feeling for what it is to live that way.
Well, you know, one of the really curses of humanity from the dawn of consciousness has been sort of cultural myopia. You know, when the great Greek traveler Herodotus traveled the known world and went back to Athens and had the temerity to suggest to Plato that he had found some really curious and wondrous things in the kingdom of Persia and beyond, Plato wanted him killed for the audacity of preferring the barbarian to his own people. The word barbarian, incidentally, comes from the Greek barbarous, one who babbles, and if you didn't speak Greek, you didn't exist. And that kind of cultural myopia, the idea that my way is the real way and everybody else is a failed attempt to be me, isn't just found in places like the States or you know, that is famously sort of labeled with being somewhat self-absorbed, often unjustly. But all peoples like that, most indigenous tribal names translate the people, the implication being that the characters beyond the horizon are somehow savages beyond the pale. The Aztec had exactly that same notion. If you didn't speak Nahuatl, you didn't exist. And that's really been a common curse of humanity. And so, you know, we tend to think that our way is exceptional, that we're not a culture, that we're not a product of our own culture and history. And, you know, that cult of progress, which has been, you know, so much a benchmark of the West, was at its strongest ebb in the 19th century, you know, where this notion of Victorian optimism and the world getting better. But we forget that that whole concept was crushed in the blood and mud of Flanders in the Great War. The Great War was the birth of modernity, and it was a child of, you know, nihilism and doubt. And so that idea of progress has been dented, if you will. But a perfect example of the contrast would be to go to the opposite end of the world, both geographically but also kind of intellectually, to the land of the Aboriginal people in Australia. Now, we now know from studies of the Y chromosome that they were probably the very first people to walk out of Africa. And in a short span of 5,000 years, they traversed the underbelly of Asia to cross the water to get to this most parsimonious of continents. And there's even new data that they may have gotten there as early as 80,000 years, which would change our whole thinking about when human beings walked out of Africa. But be that as it may, whether they've been there for 55,000 years or 80,000 years, they got there and they went walking. And they created, over the course of generations, 10,000 clan territories, which were like a matrix over the entire continent. And all those clan territories were linked by a single idea, and that was the dreaming. And the dreaming wasn't a dream. It was this notion that the world both exists and is constantly waiting to be formed. In not one, speaking of time, in not one of the 670 languages and dialects of Australia was there a word for time or a word for past, present, and future. Now, when the British washed ashore in Australia in the late 18th century, they weren't really prepared for the subtlety of the Aboriginal mind. They looked at how they lived. They looked at a simple people who looked strange, simple technology. But what really offended the British was that the Aboriginal people clearly had no notion of progress, no notion of time, no interest whatsoever in improving upon their material lot. And the British, in their inimitable way, concluded that the Aboriginal people weren't actually human at all, and they began, frankly, to shoot them. And it's astonishing to recall that in the lifetime of my own grandfather, in 1902, it was debated in Parliament in Melbourne as to whether or not Aboriginal people were human or not. As recently as the 1950s, there were quotas that ranchers had as to how many abos could be shot with impunity who trespassed upon their land or their ranches. In the 1960s, there was a school book, an Australian anthropologist told me he was obliged to read as a kid, called The Treasury of Fauna of Australia, that included the Aboriginal people as examples of the interesting wildlife of the continent. Now, what was really going on was something too subtle for the British to grasp in those early years, and that was the dreaming. It turns out that the entire purpose of life in Australia was the antithesis of progress. It was stasis. The goal was to do what was necessary ritually within your clan territory, not to change the world, but rather to keep the world exactly as it was at the time of its creation, when the rainbow serpent spread itself upon the land and the ancestors were said to have sung the world into existence. Now, it's almost as if you could think of, you know, if Western civilization had done nothing throughout the long course of our history save prune the shrubs in the Garden of Eden to keep it just as it was when Adam and Eve had their fateful conversation. Now, again, I try very hard not to judge in some sense in as an anthropologist looking at deep history. It's not a judgment, but it's simply an observation that, yes, if human beings as a whole had followed that intellectual trajectory of the Aboriginal people, we wouldn't have put a man on the moon, or we wouldn't have solved the mysteries of human health as we have, to the extent that we have. But on the other hand, you could also say we wouldn't be talking about climate change and our proclivity to impact the Earth in such ways that it may transform the capacity of all of us to survive on the planet. And so over the long course of history, you have to ask yourself, in fact, which of those two adaptations may prove to have been the wiser path.
Right, right. Well, and this is the thing. I mean, you write so much about mythological structures that indigenous societies have, and many of them, if not all of them, put human beings at the center. The idea that humans are that which hold the whole natural world together through the song, the dreaming or the singing, the songs that you were talking about, or the land is breathed into by human consciousness. What is the function of myths like this, and how do they influence moral and ethical codes and how people treat the land and ecosystems and so on?
That's a wonderful question. The key thing about many of these societies, in my experience, is that they don't see people as a problem, but the solution. You know, the whole systems of reciprocity that occur in the Andes, for example, where human beings are seen to be perfectly desirous of expecting bounty from the earth, but at the same time, they owe something to the earth itself. And so, you know, we tend to view human life as unfolding on a stage in which the other sentient creatures of the world are kind of props in the drama of the human experience. And we also, you know, we can actually trace in our own intellectual lineage where we began to think about the earth as we do. I mean, one of the things that always perplexed me when I worked as a kid as an industrial logger, you know, playing my role in tearing down the greatest temperate rainforests on the face of the planet. And I always thought, you know, why, how can we be doing this? And it struck me that we're able to do it because we've deanimated the world. And if you actually go back in our tradition, you know, during the Renaissance and certainly into the Enlightenment, as we tried to free ourselves from the tyranny of absolute faith, we wanted to liberate the individual from the collective, which was sort of the sociological equivalent of splitting the atom. But we also wanted to sort of liberate ourselves from this suffocating absolute faith. And so when Descartes in the Enlightenment declared that all that existed was mind and material, in a kind of single gesture, he deanimated the world. And all notions of myth, magic, mysticism were simply swept from the realm of possibilities. And more importantly, they swept metaphor from the realm of possibilities. So, for example, I grew up in a world in British Columbia where the rainforest existed to be cut. That was the foundation of the scientific forestry that I studied in school and practiced in the woods. The idea of sustained yield was predicated on the assumption that all the forests would be cut and replaced by plantations. That made me very different than my friends amongst the Kwakwaka'wakw, who believed that those forests were the abode of Hukuk and the crooked beak of heaven and the cannibal spirits at the north end of the world that would have to be embraced or engaged in the Hamet's initiation, such that the wisdom of the wild could be placated. Now, the question isn't who's right and who's wrong. Is that forest mere cellulose and board feet? Is it the domain of the spirits? The interesting thing is the metaphor itself, the belief system that mediates the relationship between any human population and the natural world. If you believe that forest is simply cellulose and board feet, you readily cut it down. But if you believe it's the abode of the divine, you'll have a different relationship to it. You and I, for example, were raised to believe that a mountain is a pile of rock ready to be mined. That's just the way we thought about it. That makes you and I very different than my godchildren in Peru, raised to believe that a mountain is an Apu deity that will direct their destiny. Again, it's not about who's right and who's wrong. It's how the belief system as a metaphor plays out with profoundly different consequences for the ecological footprint of a culture. Now, you asked specifically about myth. One of the most extraordinary things that anthropology has unveiled over the last really 40 years is amongst the people of the Anaconda that I write about in the book, The Wayfinders, where we've come to understand that their mythology and cosmology is, when deconstructed, nothing less than an incredibly intricate and complex land management plan that dictates precisely how people in great numbers could have lived in the upland forests of the Amazon, as we now know that they did. So that, for example, you may, in a very practical sense, you may have some mythological tale that says that you must not fish in this particular bend of the river. And then you look into it biologically and discover that's where a particular species of fish spawns. And so there's this, you know, it's not a direct thing, but it becomes a complex by which the footprint of the people in the land is softened. So, you know, I think a really important thing is in all of this is not to embrace the silliness of the myth of the ecological native as if these indigenous people or any people are inherently pure, which is sort of silly and almost racist in its simplicity, or to denigrate ourselves. I mean, if you and I ripped off our arm in a car accident, we surely wouldn't want to be taken to a shaman. So it's not about saying who's right and who's wrong. It's trying to understand that everybody's got something to say. Everybody deserves a place at the council of human wisdom, if you will. And so we tend to measure success by the criteria of our own society, which tends to be technological wizardry and material progress. But, you know, think for a second, if a Martian anthropologist came to Earth, he sure it would see wonderful things in Canada or in the States. And if the measure of success was technological capacity, we'd certainly shine. But if they looked at our social structure, they'd ask some obvious questions. You revere marriage, but half your marriages end in divorce. You say that you love your elders, but only 6% of your homes have grandparents and grandchildren beneath the same roof. I know you love your kids, but you have this weird obsession with work leading to the slogan 24/7, which may account for why your children, by the age of 18, have spent 3 years watching video games or television or computer screens, contributing to an obesity epidemic. I know you pride yourself on your contentment, but you do consume 2/3 of the world's antipsychotic drugs, even while you put 400,000 tons of toxic waste into your rivers every day, every year. You have a, you can go on and
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
And so it's not to judge us. It's just to say that we and no people are the paragon of human potential, and that, you know, just as we have so much to contribute, the genius of allopathic medicine, the brilliance of our technological acuity, so too these other societies have something to tell us about the art of being alive.
Well, and there's something disingenuous, even to the greatest materialist, I think, about the material worldview, if you were confronted with the person you love to say, this is a sack of blood and bones, as opposed to this is the person I love. I mean, those are, at a certain point, the pure materialism breaks down in the face of what's really meaningful to us.
Well, you know, there's a long passage in the Wayfinders about the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and I've spent a great deal of time in Tibet, and you know, the Buddhists spend their entire lives getting ready for a moment that we spend our entire lives trying to forget, and that's the moment of death. And you know, the Buddha said to try to, there's nothing wrong with material objects and possessions. They make life pleasant. But he said to find ultimate satisfaction from the material realm is like a fisherman trying to cast a net onto a dry riverbed. And, you know, it's not just a Buddhist. This is a message of all the sages of history. I mean, Lord knows, we all know people of great affluence, either directly or through gossip. And we all know that wealth is no measure of happiness and no avenue to spiritual contentment. I mean, that has to be one of the greatest follies of anyone who thinks that that's the path to contentment. It just doesn't seem to work out, does it?
I mean, not at the high end, but at the low end. I remember once coming home with a pair of warm pants and thinking, you know, material things do make me happy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not talking about, I'm not advocating cloth, and self-flagellation and cloth suits. And I totally believe in a process of equity and social justice that would allow all human beings to live with dignity and pride, you know. But I'm just saying that the pursuit of wealth as a rationale for existence always ends up in disappointment.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation supports education along the cradle to career spectrum by investing in Northern New Mexico school districts, nonprofit education programs, and community projects. Education and community grants of up to $2,500 are available to qualified education programs that serve the counties of Los Alamos, Mora, Rio Arriba, San Miguel, Sandoval, Santa Fe, or Taos. 2019 grant application deadlines are February 15th and August 15th. For more information or to apply, visit lanlfoundation.org/grants. That's lanlfoundation.org/grants.
And now back to our program with Wade Davis.
Something that you said a moment ago was a line from the book The Wayfinders that really jumped off the page to me, and that was that the enlightenment process in which the individual was liberated, quote-unquote, from the collective was the sociological equivalent of splitting the atom. Can you say more about what you mean by that?
Well, you know, think about when you've got some friends get married, and what do we say? We say, oh, John and Sally are going to start a family, right? But it's kind of an indication of how atomized our society is, because John and Mary already have families, right? And yet we don't think of that. And in the Enlightenment, part of the whole quest was both to liberate, as I said, ourselves from tyranny of absolute faith, which is what sparked the entire genius of modernity, the freedom of modernity. But it also, in a social sense, you know, we liberated the individual from the collective. And now you and I don't think any American or Canadian would want to go back to a world where we are utterly dominated by the matrix of the community in which we were born. I mean, that's part of our whole dream of mobility and individualism and so on. But it does come, I won't say with a cost, but with consequences, you know. And so we live in a world where it's quite normal to have, you know, Aunt Sally living in Boca Raton and the cousins up in Detroit and somebody else in Southern California. I mean, we live basically in a world in which the individual is preeminent. And that brings with it great possibilities, but also the possibility of isolation and loneliness. I'll tell you an interesting story. I mean, the reason the collective becomes made so strong in so many societies is because this individual without the collective could be imperiled. And I remember a First Nations community here in British Columbia many years ago where, in a terrible tragedy, someone I knew got drunk and literally killed his brother with an axe. And then stood over the bleeding corpse, preventing any medical care coming to the rescue. And the fellow obviously was charged and did time in penitentiary and came back to the community. And the non-native society in that valley was sort of shocked at the ease with which this character was reabsorbed into the community. But they failed to understand that the people didn't absorb him because of a forgiveness per se, but they did so for the strength of the community. In other words, the community must accept all people back and deal with the consequences of that, because the integrity of the community is the key to the cultural survival of the people. And that's something one sees in, you know, indigenous people. Yes, I'm not even sure I like that word indigenous. I mean, just one sees in small communities around the world.
Another thing that I want to ask you, that it kind of got me thinking from the mythological and that very anthropocentric mythological perspective that you write about, for many of us in the West, our creation myth is from science, which is very much not anthropocentric. I mean, science conceives of a world in which human beings are latecomers. They're not the central force that holds the whole thing together. In fact, science is showing us how we, or many of us, are failing at holding it together. We're agents of destruction. How do you think the non-anthropocentrism of the scientific view has shaped us culturally, if it has?
Well, I think it's always important to remember that there's no real automatic clash between science and religion, because after all, science answers the question how, and religion answers the question why. I remember once I was in the Coptic country of Jamaica, a very interesting place in the central part of the island. The filmmaker friend of mine and a local Obia man, we were walking through a meadow. It was a meadow of mimosa, the sensitive plant, you know, and you know how the leaves fold up in response to touch. And my American filmmaker friend asked me, you know, why do they do that? And I responded, I can't tell you why they do it. I can tell you how they do it. And I began to speak of osmotic gradients and so on. But then the Obia man interjected and he said, man, I can tell you why they do it. They feel shame, man. In other words, two very different sets of questions being asked by science and religion. And that said, I think that there's a kind of a new religion inspired by science. I mean, sometimes, you know, when people often in the evangelical community will say that, you know, environmentalism has become like a new religion, and there's sort of a tendency to deny that. But in fact, it's true. I mean, I feel that part of what's emerging is, as more and more people understand the wonder of science, and hopefully scientists will continue to do a better and better job of sharing their considerable wisdom, people begin to simply bask in the true glory of creation. I mean, one of the, when people like the Kogi or the Arawako speak of water as sacred essence, they're not invoking mythic conceits or cliches. They're actually describing a world that only science in its wonder has fully unveiled. And I always find it fascinating, for example, how, you know, children in school are asked to recite patriotic slogans, or they remember popular ditties, they know the names of 1,000 brands of commercial products, but not one in a million is asked ever to recite the fundamental formula of life, which is in fact our kind of fundamental creation myth. And that, of course, is photosynthesis, this amazing thing that, you know, carbon dioxide and water sparked by photons of light produce carbohydrate and oxygen, without which none of us could live. You would think that that very simple molecular formula, that kind of inspiring metabolic pathway, which really ought to be seared into our imaginations as if it was, in fact, a prayer. And yet, most of us can't even name a common plant, you know. So I think science can in fact, inform the spiritual quest in a kind of holistic way that makes us finally appreciate this world that we live in and of which we're a part of. I mean, and I'm actually very optimistic because if you think about it, when we were kids, I'm not sure how old you are, you sound rather young, but when I was young, you know, just getting people to stop throwing garbage out of a car window was a great environmental victory. Nobody spoke about the biosphere or biodiversity, and now these terms are part of the vernacular of school children. You know, I mean, the idea of having a ministry of the environment would have been an absurdity in the 1950s. Now there's no nation on earth that doesn't have a robust ministry devoted to that subject. So, you know, in the same way that, you know, it's so easy to indulge pessimism, but whenever I always feel that pessimism is an indulgence, just as despair is an insult to the imagination, orthodoxy, the threat to creativity. I mean, in my lifetime, women have gone from the kitchen to the boardroom, people of color from the woodshed to the White House, gay people from the closet to the altar. I mean, what's not to love about a world capable of such social and reinvention? So I tend to feel that increasingly the appreciation of the natural world, the wonder of it, not the fragility of it as much as our capacity to severely impact it in this age of the Anthropocene, has got to emerge as some kind of, I don't know, article of faith if we aren't going to damage the biosphere to the point of true disaster.
One thing that I was thinking about, or that struck me when reading The Wayfinders, was that a lot of our national and international discourse is essentially communism versus capitalism, as if those were the two poles. And I was really struck by the fact when I was reading that you think of those two things as kind of two sides of the same coin. They're both born of a mechanistic and industrial mentality. They both have these kind of high ideals of progress. Talk about that, how those ideologies in some ways are more alike than different, and how they've affected, you know, like the word indigenous, whatever, it's societies that you've studied.
You know, they're both products of Western intellectual discourse. You know, Marxism, you know, emerged from the pen of a German philosopher who distilled his ideas in the reading room of the British Library in the 19th century. And, you know, and the essential fantasy of Marxism was the social malleability, the human spirit, the idea that we can somehow envision an ideal man, woman, and therefore chart a course to the transformation of society. And of course, it completely ignored all notions of, you know, myth, impulse, moan, the poetry of the stars, the sound of rain on stones. I mean, this had no place in a world of reinvention. I mean, and the horror of communism came when people then became reduced to material pegs on a pegboard. And if people didn't get with the program, they could be simply eliminated and they became just statistics. I've always found it fascinating how communist systems deal with and impose terror and horror as opposed to fascist systems. You know, communism, you know, if you don't get with the system, you're just a mere statistic to be eliminated, as we saw in the case of Stalin or Mao. But with fascism, you know, it's more like the people have a fantasy of a world that no longer exists or never existed, but has to be presumed to have existed to rationalize their own bigotry and fears and so on. And so fascists tend to have to destroy the ideas of dissidents. They have to burn the books. They have to go after the individuals in a very personal and direct way. But all of these systems are, of course, products of Western ideas and Western thought. And, you know, I've obviously spent much of my life amongst peoples who don't share in those fundamental assumptions. I mean, certainly both capitalism and Marxism focus exclusively on the material sphere, on the material well-being of individuals. I mean, capitalism essentially argues that if you free up the individual and free up the markets and allow people to enter into a kind of a collective struggle for dominance, that it will work for the better of all, the better of the society, the economic well-being of people. But it's all based on the idea that the ultimate goal is a generation of capital and wealth. And in a similar way, the Marxist system really doesn't stray from the obsession with material well-being. It simply argues that material well-being should be more evenly distributed and should be in the hands of those who produce the goods as opposed to those who move capital and consume the goods. But, I mean, they're both systems derived, in a sense, from the same impulse and of materialism. And one of the things that I write about in the book, of course, is Malinowski's fantastic work that's legendary in anthropology of the Kula Ring in off the coast of New Guinea in the Trobriand Islands, where, you know, Malinowski was of Polish origins, and so in World War One he was detained by the British authorities, and he stayed on those Trobriand Islands for some years, and he had been trained at the London School of Economics at a time when the world of economics was either capitalism or Marxism. And suddenly he encountered this sort of strange system whereby symbolic goods of no material value but of great prestige were causing individuals to set out into the open sea at the risk of their lives merely to pass on this ritual object to the next island in the chain of exchange that went around this great archipelago. And one ritual object, a necklace, would go clockwise, the armband would go counterclockwise, and it could take up to 20 years for a single object to move around the chain. But it was a form of economic activity in which the movement and the transactions were all mediated by this exchange of an object that had no utilitarian value. And so this, the insights that he came away with really changed the whole idea of economics and the notion that economic activity and exchange was always fundamental about material and utilitarian goals.
You are an anthropologist, and it's your work to, as you said, study cultures and not pass value judgments. But I mean, you sort of can't help it on some level. I mean,
that's a really important point. In fact, just you know, anthropologists are always often accused of embracing a kind of extreme relativism, you know, as if any human behavior must be accepted simply because it exists. Nothing could be further from the truth. Anthropology never calls for the elimination of judgment. It calls for the suspension of judgment so that the very judgments that we are ethically and morally obliged to make as human beings can be informed ones. I mean, you know, obviously there's certain traits of human behavior that I would be the first to say that could be placed in the dustbin of history all for the betterment of people. I mean, the extreme female circumcision, genital mutilation that occurs in cultures in East Africa, for example. I mean, I've been with many female anthropologists from universities in that part of the world who will defend that practice on cultural grounds. On the other hand, I also know a woman who stood up against it and, with the help of a friend of mine, actually was able to photograph the procedure and take it over to the men's circle beneath the tree and actually show the men what they had been doing to their sisters, mothers, and daughters for generations. And once they actually saw it, the practice stopped in that community that day. But the anthropological lens is really most usefully brought into focus when it's shone upon a cultural practice that we judge, but of which we know little. And a perfect example of that, which I also write about in the book, would be voodoo in the Afro-Caribbean reality of Haiti, and elsewhere, Brazil and so on. I mean, voodoo we think of as a black magic cult, but voodoo is simply a Fon word from Dahomey that means spirit or God. And, you know, were I to ask any of your listeners to name the great religions of the world, what would they say? Christianity, Buddhism, Judaism, Hinduism, whatever. What continent's always left out? Sub-Saharan Africa, the assumption being that people south of the Sahara had no religious beliefs. Well, of course they did, and voodoo is just a distillation of those profound religious ideas. So that's where the anthropological lens can be useful. I mean, it just becomes a way of thinking about the world, you know. I mean, you know, here's an interesting thing that no one ever comments on. You know, we always lament the decline of public education in both Canada and the United States. And we always point the finger at the teachers' unions or the fact that schools are being asked to deal with social challenges that used to be dealt with in the home and so on. But the central point is always overlooked. And however you all are, both you and I went to school, in elementary school in the 50s, 60s, and so on, and we had great schools. But the reason we had grade schools is because back then the only options for a woman were secretarial work, nursing, or teaching. So if you look back on it in the 1950s and early 60s, gosh, we were taught by women who today would be running Hewlett-Packard, who would be lawyers and doctors as they are today. And so part of what was going on in that great education system we had in the public schools after the Second World War in particular is that the whole culture was benefiting because women were essentially subsidizing the education through the restrictions placed upon them by the society in terms of other career opportunities. So you think about that, and then you suddenly see that we'll never be able to draw to teaching an equivalent cohort of talent unless we absolutely transform the prestige and the economic rewards of teaching, which is something that we desperately need to do. But I think that's sort of an example of how the anthropological lens can begin to kind of, in some ways, deconstruct things that are happening all around us. I mean, how about, you know, here's a good one, like what about football and baseball? You know, have you ever really thought why those sports are so different? You know, think about baseball. There are no time limits. There are no spatial limits. It's a game of heroes, a game of individuals, and it's also a game that grew up in the sandlots of the American countryside in the wake of enduring the Civil War, and it was quintessentially a 19th century sport. The famous stripes of the New York Yankees were based on the uniforms that the engineers wore on the trains that closed the American frontier. The outfielders used to be called scouts. It was very much a 19th century sport, and then football, by contrast, emerged not from the neighborhoods, but from the colleges of the 1920s. And it was, in a way, the distillation of this emerging corporate society. I mean, you know, football is rigorously controlled time-wise and spatially. The players are kind of anonymous in those helmets. They're cogs in machine. We watch on Sunday as they get replaced effortlessly by, you know, another player. And so those sports become kind of windows on two very different eras of American history. And I think that's sort of the fun of anthropology. It's not all about, you know, identifying societies in peril or languages on the eve of on the edge of extinction, although that's all part of it. And activism has always been part of the mandate of anthropology. You know, Franz Boas, the great founder of North American anthropology, his student Ruth Benedict famously said that the entire purpose of anthropology is to make the world safe for human differences. And in that sense, anthropology is kind of an antidote to the nativism that is stalking the country today.
Well, and I think for somebody like me, who reads a lot of books, but most of, you know, many of them are about topics that are kind of issues at hand. It made me, I mean, reading this particular book just now over the last couple of days kind of made me feel small, made me feel humble, made me feel my own deficiencies, not in a bad way, but contemplating what these Polynesian navigators, for example, are able to do is extraordinary. I mean, the subtlety with which they are able to read waves and sky and water and air and winds and currents and things like that. And I found myself thinking, you know, I know so little about that because I don't have to. Would I trade the comforts of my middle-class life for that knowledge? Probably not. Am I therefore the source of the crisis?
That's a great point, though. You know, no one expects you to become a Penan. But at the same time, we shouldn't expect the Penan to become you.
Right.
And the entire cult of modernity is based on this idea that all of these people should be extracted from their traditional ways of life to become part of the modern world. I mean, that's an old, old canard. And too often that is just an excuse to disenfranchise people from landscapes upon which their presence is an inconvenience to industrial interests. And in celebrating, for example, the Wayfinders, again, if you look at that book, I'm never trying to judge or put us down and elevate or idealize the life of anyone. The genesis of all those stories, really, was my mission at the National Geographic. And I was recruited there as one of the explorers in residence in 1999, I think it was, as part of the conservation initiative of the NGS. And my assigned task was in a decade to helped change the way the world viewed and valued culture. And the way we thought to do that was not through conferences or polemics, but through storytelling. And so my idea was to go out and not do what so many traditional ethnographic films had done, you know, sort of celebrate the exoticism of the other. We deliberately went to places and stories where the beliefs and practices were so dazzling that we hoped that people would just witness that and come away with a deeper appreciation of this central message of anthropology, which is that every culture, you know, has something to say, and each is a manifestation of our common human genius. So, you know, the first story we did was Polynesia because it was such a story that could allow us to do that so well. I mean, here were people who, you know, could name 300 stars in the night sky, you know, people who could sense the presence of distant atolls of islands beyond the visible horizon by simply watching the reverberation of waves across the hull of a vessel. These were people who could, you know, in the darkness in the ocean, could distinguish multiple sea swells, distinguishing those caused by local weather disturbances from the deep currents that pulsated across the ocean and could be followed like a terrestrial explorer would follow a river to the sea. I mean, and the amazing thing about that tradition is that it was all based on dead reckoning. And dead reckoning means that you only know where you are on the open ocean by remembering precisely how you got there. Now, it was the impossibility of using that methodology that kept most European transports hugging the shores of continents until the British solved the problem of longitude with the invention of the chronometer. But we know for a scientific fact that 10 centuries before Christ, the ancestors of the Polynesians from an ancient civilization near New Caledonia and New Guinea called Lapita set out into the rising sun. And in 1,000 years, they reached Tonga and Samoa and Fiji, and then they stopped. And 1,000 years later, they sailed on, reaching 4,000 kilometers across the ocean of the Marquesas, northwest to Hawaii, southeast to Rapa Nui, eventually reaching Aotearoa, which is what we now call New Zealand, settling the biggest ocean on Earth. And they didn't have a single modern navigational aid, no sextant, no compass, no GPS, obviously, no transponder. And incredibly, they did not have the written word. So this implied that the wayfinder, the navigator, over the course of a multi-week journey, literally had to, using our common human genius, remember every sign of the sea, every sign of the stars, the moon, the sun, and chart a course in his mind or her mind, pulling the islands out of the sea, as they metaphorically say. And, you know, in the book, The Wayfinders, and all the stories, we try to find cultures which really have something to say. I mean, and there's kind of a, we always sort of had a punchline, if you will. You know, I mean, for Polynesia, the punchline was, you know, if you took all of the genius that allowed us to put a man on the moon and applied it to an understanding of the ocean, what you'd get is Polynesia.
Right.
And then when we went off to look at Tibetan Buddhism with Matthieu Ricard, you know, the seminal moment was when we encountered a woman who lived in isolation as a retreatant for 45 years, and she opened the door for the first time in 45 years, and her face wasn't that of a mad woman, but one who radiated loving compassion. And the Lama who was with us said, you know, the proof of the science of the mind that is Tibetan Buddhism is the serenity of the practitioner. And he later said to me that, you know, we in Tibet don't believe that you went to the moon, but you did. You may not believe that we achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, but we can. So that's what the book is really about. It's all about these stories of, you know, the Inuit surviving not by being afraid of the cold, but by taking advantage of it. The notion of dreaming, the songlines in Australia, the elder brother, the Wiwa and the Pogi and the Arawakos in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. I do most of my work now in Colombia. I was just made an honorary Colombian citizen by President Santos before he left office. And it's astonishing to think that in that soaring volcanic massif of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, the highest coastal mountain range on Earth, to this day, the three societies of the elder brother are still ruled by a ritual priesthood. They believe that their prayers maintain the ecological balance of the world, and they look down from the heights on the very beaches that Columbus landed on in 1499. So it's amazing to think that more than 500 years after the Spanish conquest, this voice, pre-Columbian voice, may still be heard unfettered in the mountains of Columbia, not 2 hours by plane from Miami Beach. So, you know, these are all to me kind of symbols of hope, the geography of hope.
All of this is true, and all of it is endlessly fascinating and important. And I think the through line, and one of the things that is certainly a through line of your book, is that these different societies, these different cultures can teach us about how we can deal with our problem. And the main problems that we have are climate change and pollution and what they're doing to others. And, you know, I can sort of think about the relativism of cultures and the greatness of Western technology and the greatness of Polynesian navigation. But what's different is that we Westerners are basically keeping this very destructive, extractive economy alive and feeding into it through our consumerism, which is so much of our way of life. And so I feel like, I mean, that's the question. Can they teach us real alternative to the way we live?
Well, we certainly can learn. And the question is, are we willing to change? The point is that we are changing, but maybe not as quickly or as dramatically maybe we can't quantify the change, but it's happening. It's happening all around us. But, you know, when I did write that book and the editor, the publisher did put on that subtitle, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, it kind of forced me to answer that question. And I did so implicitly throughout the book, but at the end, I did so quite explicitly with two words. And those two words were climate change. Again, not to suggest for a second that we go back to a pre-industrial past or that any society on Earth be kept from the genius and the products of modernity that can improve their lives. I use the word climate change in the sense that the very existence, the demonstrable existence of completely different ways of thinking that this book and other anthropological texts demonstrate and reveal, it puts a lie to those of us in our society who say that we cannot change, as we know we all must change, the fundamental way we interact with the planet. You know, the reason cultural myopia, in a sense, is not simply a sign of ignorance. Ignorance meaning lack of knowledge. I mean, I'm not being demeaning in the term ignorance. It means without gnosis, without knowledge. The reason it's so dangerous is it reinforces the idea that our way is the only way possible, and therefore even the thought that we would change any parts of the fundamental structure of our society or economics is impossible because, after all, we are the only way. I think that kind of thinking is really detrimental and potentially disastrous. The very existence of multiple realities, multiple ways of thinking about the world, multiple ways of adapting and living on the planet suggests that there are infinite layers and possibilities, and it puts a lie to those of us who say that there's only one way. And it allows us to realize that we really do need to shift some of the fundamentals of our thinking and of our behavior in order to survive on the planet and keep the planet as we would like it to be as we pass it on to our children.
Wade Davis, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And once again, Wade Davis will be speaking here in Santa Fe, New Mexico on Tuesday, February 26th on the subject Why Ancient Wisdom Matters. It's at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center. For more information, lenzik.org. And thanks again to our sponsors, the Lenzik Performing Arts Center and Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, who are making this season of the Radio Cafe possible. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.